Freedom of the press is only guaranteed when you own the press.
It's time to hear the other side of the news.
Communication breakdown. Pause for the message. Wake up. Every station is a gentrification. Global syndication is the shaping of the nation. ABC, Disney, NBC, GE, Murder gets Foxy, and with a hint, he owns a pen, the camera, the sword, by a Coke, by a Ford, getting broke, getting bored.
The other side of the news.
What we want, what we need, what we want, what we need, but do we even know who plants the seeds? You think the media works for you, but it's a job for them, they're just selling fruit. Flim flam diagram, data jam, handicap, caught it, yo, you bought it. A mind is a profitable thing to waste, you want another taste, baby? Freedom is a rumor.
In studio today, we have with us Mr. Jack Santa Barbara, who is currently a board member of Environment Hamilton. He has in the past been involved with Vision 2020. I'll let Jack fill us in from there.
Yes, a couple of years ago when Action 2020 was in existence, I served as the co-chair after being on the board for a year or so.
Action 2020. Do you want to take a second and just explain what that is?
As most listeners will probably know, Vision 2020 was something established by the municipality back in the early 1990 or so, and it was a plan to make Hamilton a sustainable community, and it involved considerable citizen participation and developed an extensive following in the city. Subsequent to that, it was determined that it would be helpful if there were a arm's-length not-for-profit organization that connected more directly with the community, whereas what the city was doing was looking after its own kind of operation. But they needed a group to connect that with public and private sector organizations and ordinary citizens in terms of bringing them on board, because obviously making a community sustainable is a project that has to involve everyone. So the city funded it for a few years, but then the funding stopped.
Okay, so right now we're focusing on the problems with peak oil and our own local aerotropolis, the Hamilton Airport area. And we're going to try and tie the two connections together, why some people in this area are not embracing the idea of the aerotropolis. I want to just mention about peak oil just quickly and talk about how it affects.
I'll just try to provide a little introduction to the concept of peak oil and relate it first to broader energy issues and then relate that to the aerotropolis issue. Peak oil is a very well-known phenomenon by geologists that indicates when the production from a conventional oil well will reach its peak production. That is when the most amount of oil can be extracted from the source, and it's basically like a bell-shaped curve for every individual well. And it has to do with some of the physical properties of an oil well. When you stick a hole in the ground where there's oil, there's also pressure from gas, and that pressure pushes the oil out, so it's very easy to retrieve and extract. However, as the extraction continues, that gas pressure declines, and then some substitute has to be created, either by putting in additional gas of some sort or even water in some cases. So at some point in that process, the production, that is, extraction, reaches a peak in terms of the number of barrels that can come out at a time or during a day, and then it declines. And this phenomenon can be looked at an individual well level or a particular field, or more broadly, for an entire nation. And several nations, for example, have already reached peak oil. The United States, for example, reached peak oil in 1970. And something like 24, I believe, of the 44 major oil-producing countries have already reached peak oil. So the big issue is, when will global peak oil occur? Now, interestingly, there are very differing views about this, and they tend to split between geologists and economists. The geologists indicate that peak oil is likely to occur anytime between the year 2000, that is, it may have already occurred, up to about 2016. The methods for calculating this are pretty straightforward. The reason that there are such a variety of estimates is that the basic data that goes into the formula is private. It's proprietary. It's controlled by oil companies and a few sheikdoms. And they, of course, have their own economic interests.
So how do we find out which is the truth behind it, if they're privately held?
Well, it's not easy. I think people basically have to judge for themselves. There's a considerable amount of information available on the web. If people were to just put peak oil into a search engine, I would encourage them to look very carefully at the source of the information, whether it's an independent source, such as the Association for Peak Oil, which is a group of geologists, mostly retired, who don't seem to have any vested interest in peak oil being this year or that year or any other year, whereas a lot of the other estimates are made by groups that have a very strong vested interest. So
the truth point behind all of this research and discussion is the fact that whether it's this year, whether it's past, whether it's 20 years from now, we can't continue going on. We do now. We can't use energy the same way. We can't drive our cars the same way. We have to change society in a very big way.
Yeah, I think that's exactly the point. Regardless of whether it's already passed or it's going to occur within the next 5 to 10 years, which is where most estimates place it, it means a dramatic change. And again, just a little bit of kind of background on oil in particular and fossil fuels in general. If we look historically at how energy sources evolved over the last century or two, what we see is that as we made a move in, say, the 1850s when oil was discovered, it was really quite an incredible and an exceptional event in human history, because we went from burning wood, essentially, and using wind power, you know, to sail ships or turn windmills and do things of that sort, to using oil, first coal and then shortly after that oil. The thing about wood, for example, there's a concept that's very, very important related to this whole issue that I think it's very important for your listeners to understand, and that is the net energy concept, or energy return on energy invested.
How much it costs to produce.
Yeah, that's right. How much energy it costs to produce, how many BTUs do you have to put out in terms of, say, human effort to cut a cord of wood relative to the amount of energy or BTUs you get out of that wood? The estimates are roughly 30 to 1. When we went to coal, we moved from that to 50, 60, 70 to 1. With oil, sweet crude oil, it's 100 to 1. So you can see it's quite an incredible increase. And so we're able to do incredibly more work with the oil than we would otherwise if we're simply relying on human power or even wood fuel. So we've really built our entire culture, our communities, our cities, our institutions around the availability of this kind of oil. And just to put it in a bit of perspective, came across an interesting statistic that looked at the equivalent number of human slaves that are available to the average North American on a 7-day-a-week, 24-hour basis. And it comes out that each of us in Canada and the U.S. has at our disposal on a daily basis approximately 75 human slaves.
Can you explain that to me just a little bit more?
Everything we do relies on energy. For example, another interesting example was recently in an email from someone, and it had to do with the amount of energy used in a washing machine to just wash one load of clothes. And what they did was they calculated that it was equivalent to taking an average North American home and lifting it 23 feet in the air. That's how much energy is used in a single washing machine, one load of clothes. The overall point I'm trying to make to reinforce the point you've made and implied in your question is that oil is and the entire fossil fuel era really is an exception in terms of the way we are able to use energy relative to our ancestors prior to 1850 and very likely future generations in terms of beyond the middle of the century. One of the things that people say if they accept the idea of peak oil and that we're going to experience a decline in the availability of oil soon, and of course, that will go along with a considerable rise in prices. But I think it's important for people to understand that even as prices increase, that the more significant issue is the actual availability of the oil. It's not going to be available regardless of what you're willing to pay. This is really dramatic because the substitutes for oil are not nearly as flexible as oil. For example, we can't use solar power to fly an airplane. We can't use wood to fly an airplane. Now, we can certainly go to hot air balloons or dirigibles or something like that, but that's hardly, going to move as many people and as much goods as modern jet aircraft. So there's going to be enormous change in the amount and availability of energy.
Well, won't the price of everything else go up as well?
Of course, because everything is subsidized, in a sense, by the cheap oil that we have. I mean, the whole issue of economic globalization is based on the availability of cheap oil. So, in fact, we're already seeing that. Global trade is actually beginning to plateau. I think some of the latest statistics indicate that. So the bump in oil, I think I just was reading recently that oil prices have actually increased by 40% just this year alone. And I suggest that this is simply the beginning of price rises in oil.
Is there a way we can tie this into what's happening with our airport, this prediction of what's really going to happen? And it isn't just a prediction to worry about. It's a fact. It's coming. To plan for it. So what is our city doing to plan for it?
Peak oil is a fact. Let's first make that very clear. Again, we don't know exactly when, but the best estimates based on the science involved are that it will occur within the next decade, okay, if it hasn't occurred already. Now, the Aerotropolis is a concept based on the current city planning for the next 30 years. So this is supposed to be a long-term plan. It's called the GRIDS, the Growth-Related Integrated Development Strategy is what GRIDS stands for. And they've come up with five or six different scenarios for growth for Hamilton. And interestingly, the Aerotropolis idea is in each and every one of the options developed.
Yeah, definitely want to be a transportation hub here.
Yeah, that's the overall strategic direction, is to make Hamilton a transportation hub because of its geographic location, the lake system, the rails are down there by the water, and of course there's a highway systems that they've been building, as well as the airport. So it sounds like an attractive kind of solution to many of the woes that Hamilton has. However, when we look at it in the context of peak oil, it becomes, I think, a very risky kind of business because transportation will change dramatically. Transportation, in fact, will be the area most dramatically affected by peak oil because oil is such a flexible fuel for most transportation. 90% of it is based on oil or oil derivatives of some sort.
And I think I read someplace that flights, airplanes will be the first to feel the hit.
Well, it's hard to say which will be the first, but certainly air travel, whether it's goods or people, will be extremely vulnerable because there are really very few substitutes. I mean, you can think of electric cars, for example, as substitutes for ground transportation. We could still use rail for transporting goods, and we could use ships for transporting goods on water. But air travel is totally dependent on fossil fuels, and so will change dramatically in terms of the kinds of things that make sense economically. And the idea of people traveling, you know, as extensively as we have become accustomed to will, I think, be almost impossible.
What would be the scenario or the alternative for Hamilton if we go ahead with the plan that the city has for keeping that airport and building what they're going to build around it, the whole zoning, the industrial parks? What's the scenario going to be if there's no oil in 5 years?
Yeah, first, perhaps we should just clarify what the Aerotropolis means, because that term is a little strange. It's kind of sounds like a Greek dessert. The term is devised by the city, and what it means is that around the airport, there would be developed a commercial industrial zone, the idea being that parts would be flown into these companies and things would be assembled and they would be flown out. That's why they claim there's a need to bring it close to the airport. So the idea is to take existing farmland, which surrounds the airport, which already, by the way, has several hundred, I don't recall the exact number, but there's already several hundred acres available to the airport for such development.
Do you happen to know if there's sod farms or other crop farms?
No, I don't have a good list of what's actually available, but I do know there's extensive farmland in that area. There's some residential, but mostly it's farmland.
And it's in the Greenbelt Zone too, isn't it?
Yes, I do believe it's in the Greenbelt Zone, or certainly very close to it. So that's the basic concept, is to create the space for industries and commercial ventures that would like to be physically located next to an airport. Now, I've asked the question, why do they need to be directly adjacent to the airport? Why can't they be a few miles away and still, you know, bring their goods to the airport if that were necessary? The answer really isn't very satisfactory. It's simply that the idea of being close to an airport is one of the factors that many companies consider in choosing where to locate. But that's really beside the point. I think the basic issue is, with peak oil approaching, it's clearly going to occur, by all the best scientific estimates, well within the 30-year planning time frame for the Aerotropolis. So it seems to me a highly risky scenario to build Hamilton's future on a strategy that relies primarily on transportation of various sorts, and especially the airport, because, again, air travel will be most vulnerable. And what I would think will happen as peak oil occurs is that because air transport will become increasingly expensive and vulnerable, that there'll be a significant contraction of airports. I mean, why would we want to have a wide variety of airports if air travel is going to be reduced significantly? Then obviously we're going to need fewer airports. Whether it even makes sense to think about continuing to operate the current airport, conceivably it could be better to simply tear up the runways and convert that land to industrial or commercial land if that's really what's needed.
There's a subject of food supply that was brought up in last week's show. One of the farmers from out that area, he's been in farming business for generations after generations, and he pointed out how quickly we didn't have enough food when we had the blackout that summer in August. And we take up this land so that we can't support and feed ourselves, and we ship it from California. And we continue doing that, you know, as if that's not going to be a problem down the road.
I think the whole issue of food security is a major issue with regard to peak oil. Clearly, we're not going to be able to transport food, whether it's by air, truck, rail. All transportation is going to change. I mean, when peak oil occurs, everything is going to change. But food security in particular becomes extremely important because we can't do without food. I mean, we could do without air travel. We can't do without food. So the importance of local and regional food supplies is going to increase significantly. And the availability of good farmland to provide that food for local population is going to be critical. If this Aerotropolis idea did go ahead, if there were, in fact, expansion of the urban boundary by the 3,100 acres that is being proposed by the city, and in fact, if that land is built on, and if the kinds of industries go in there that are dirty and pollute the soil, well, I mean, we're still struggling with the brownfield developments down on the waterfront. And we know how expensive and difficult it is to remediate those lands. So I think it's a very dangerous tack to take to destroy the current agricultural land that we know is productive.
You brought up a lot of good points, and you have one of your groups or yourself and some other people have applied to the OMB concerning the Aerotropolis and this 3,000 acres. You want to tell us a bit more about why you did that and what you expect from it?
Yes. Well, as you're probably aware, the city held only one formal public meeting to discuss the proposed expansion of the urban boundary to create their lands for the Aerotropolis, and did so with about 5 or 6 days' notice, you know, to the public and so on. And the result of that, I believe there was about 27 or 28 people who actually spoke out of an audience of, I think, 150 or 200 who went into City Hall, into the council chambers. And I believe of the 27 or so who spoke, only 4 or 5 were in favor of it. Most people were expressed considerable concern. As a result of that, a second meeting was held. But I don't think it actually had official status. Nonetheless, it was very well attended. I think there were over 300 people there. And again, close to 30 people spoke, and very few were in favor. And I recall when I had an opportunity to ask a question, I actually addressed the question to the audience, and I asked how many people there were in favor of the proposal, that is to expand the urban boundary and create the Aerotropolis. And I think at best maybe between 15 and 20 people out of the 300 indicated they were supportive.
What reasons did they give?
Well, there's a variety of reasons and concerns that people are expressing. One is the loss of farmland, which we've just been talking about. Others have to do with the overall process that the city has engaged in terms of pushing this through without really consulting residents. Another concern is the fact that the Aerotropolis option is in all 5 of the grid's options or proposals.
So in other words, we don't have a plan for future growth without that airport.
Well, that's what's being proposed by the city. And, you know, I personally and others think that that's simply bad planning. You know, you need real alternatives to compare and contrast what's going to make sense. Also, we asked the question about whether they, in their planning deliberations, had given any consideration to the issue of peak oil. And the answer was no. They had not even considered it. It wasn't that they had considered it and rejected it or found that there was a way around it, but they simply had not considered it. Pressed, they came up with the issue, well, you know, there are alternative energy sources being explored. And as we discussed a little earlier, and just want to underline this because I think it's a very, very important point because many people do believe that there are alternatives. And the fact is there are no alternatives to oil. There's nothing that has the energy density or energy intensity that produces that 100-to-1 ratio of net energy gain, you know, whether it's wind or solar or ethanol or biodiesel or geothermal or wave. Nothing comes close to providing that net energy gain that oil does. So overall, we're going to have to deal with running our communities on less energy than we do today. Considerably less energy than we do today. And that means changing everything. That means changing where we live. It means changing how we trade, whether we rely on trade or we rely on local exchanges, you know, to meet our needs. It determines where we live and how that's related to where we work. It relates to how much of our own food we have to grow.
And the water and the air we breathe and
All of those issues are going to be affected, yeah.
You know, this moving of the urban boundary keeps coming up, and I constantly wonder why there isn't more action from the Greenbelt Task Force on the provincial side about questioning the city of Hamilton, you know, suggesting wanting to move the urban boundary. There doesn't seem to be much out there in the way of news.
Well, in fact, prior to the city making the formal decision to expand the urban boundary, they did receive a letter from the Ministry of Municipal Affairs and Housing. And it was really a warning shot from the ministry saying that the ministry believes the city should not expand the urban boundary, and especially because the existing GRIDS process or the long-term planning process was underway, the ministry was saying what many in the community have been saying, this should be part of that overall planning process. And in fact, there's a number of very sound planning principles that have been articulated in that planning process. And when you apply them to the Aerotropolis, I think only one or two of the 9 or 10 principles are satisfied. Anyway, the city totally disregarded that letter from the ministry. And subsequently, in fact, just a couple of days ago, the ministry has launched its own OMB appeal. So there are now 3 parties that have launched appeals against this, one being the provincial government, which I don't know whether that's unprecedented, but it's certainly an extraordinary event that the provincial government would actually launch a legal appeal against the municipality, pointing out that provincial planning standards and principles have not been satisfied. I think there's clearly something seriously wrong with the way the planning for this Aerotropolis has occurred.
Yeah, there's obviously something wrong that the methods that they use to promote and involve the community, even when they involve the community, they don't listen to what the community says. It's a small agenda for a handful of people. You got to wonder why they seem to think they have this omnipotent power that they can just override every rule and regulation, every citizen that disapproves of it.
Yeah, well, there seems to be a real sense of urgency to get this urban boundary expansion in place. And it seems to stem from the idea that Pickering Airport may go ahead.
It's a red herring, I think.
I agree. You know, if it's such a good idea, you know, from a business perspective, it'll be a good idea, you know, regardless of what else happens if we are, you know, geographically in such a advantageous position. In fact, I mean, I doubt that Pickering will go forward because of peak oil issues and concern, which I think the provincial government still hasn't quite got. But they're beginning to learn a little bit more about it. And I think when they understand the implications, that Pickering will not be a go, and nor do I think will Hamilton Airport or should be a go.
Right, I agree. I have a theory on that, watching Hamilton fairly closely for the last 10 or so years. And this is a pattern that usually comes from the mind of a lawyer. And it's suggested that if you invest and move very quickly on a project or an idea, by the time it gets into the courts, you can say, I've already spent this money. We've already moved so far into this project. It's worked for Hamilton at least once that I know of, where they can get off the hook and do bizarre things and bend rules in ways that nobody should be allowed to bend rules, especially with the environment. I think that's what's going on here, to be honest. And it's the same handful of businessmen that have paid for the lawyers and paid for the mayor to be in power, yeah, and are being hauled into court because they overspent on the campaign donations.
Well, I think the one thing that is very clear and the thing that is most certain in terms of who will benefit from the expansion of the urban boundary are the developers. I think there's no question about that. So, in fact, they were the ones that spoke at the public meetings in favor. Both the a couple of developers in the Chamber of Commerce, you know, believe that this is a a progressive thing to do for Hamilton. And to me, one of the biggest difficulties, in addition to the environmental and, you know, social and agricultural concerns, is the fact that we're not looking at alternatives. And there are alternatives. You know, if we appreciate that peak oil is inevitable, then we should really be developing our port, because shipping is a very efficient way of transporting goods. And we should be looking at how we can enhance rail service, because, again, rail is relatively environmentally friendly and efficient means of transporting goods, whereas air travel, by contrast, is the absolutely worst thing you can do environmentally in terms of transporting, you know, pound for pound. It creates more pollution. And, of course,
It's a fine particulate matter, something that comes from the jet fumes. Apparently, you're not supposed to build anything residential or industrial within 6 miles of a runway for that very reason.
That's right. I think a lot of people don't appreciate that something like 25% of the total fuel of a flight is actually consumed during takeoff. So all of those, in addition to contributing to global warming by all those flights, there's considerable amount of local air pollution that's created by that.
Is there something that you could suggest that might be helpful, useful? We've got about a couple minutes left here in the show. Some links that you might know of people can go to, or other suggestions to get people to do their own research or plan for their own personal future?
Well, there's several things. There's a book I just finished is called Power Down by Richard Heinberg, which is quite good as in terms of an introduction and overview. And in that book, he lists a number of websites where there's some useful information. So there are good sources of information. And as I mentioned, there is a group forming that has already launched the appeal, the OMB appeal against the city. And we'll be making a formal, you know, announcement of that probably in September, and certainly we'll be asking people for support. And I would encourage people to talk to their counselors, the local counselors, and let them know how they feel about this issue, and to just ask the questions about, you know, the impact on climate, the impact on agriculture and food security, the impact on oil, and why a transportation focus for our strategic direction over the next 30 years makes any sense, given that transportation is going to change dramatically. I mean, if we are to focus on transportation, let's at least do so from the perspective of peak oil. I mean, transportation will still occur. We're not saying it's going to stop, but it's going to change dramatically. And if we're really serious about our future, we need to take these sort of future trends into account.
Yes, and that brings to mind that there are several documentaries already out there kind of working their way through the public conscious, and
yes.
End of Suburbia is one.
It's an excellent one, yes.
And I'll tell you, it kept me awake for weeks, mm-hmm. The reality of that movie. There's others coming. In fact, we're going to be bringing End of Suburbia to McMaster, and I'm going to be announcing this regularly so that people know when it's coming. There's no charge to view the movie. We just want people to come and see it and hopefully join up with groups like Environment Hamilton or CATCH. And I know there's lots of other groups out there that are active. We need to bring them forward and let other people in the community know who they are, how to be reached, and what they do. And then people can take their choice of how they want to try and take back control of their lives, because, yes, we are going to have to radically change our life within 10 years.
Exactly. And I think the other thing that's very important to understand is that this is not something that people can do alone in terms of, you know, planning for this sort of change in our energy regime. It really has to be a collective solution. So we need to work together to ensure that there's not only environmental justice, but also social justice in terms of developing a new energy regime.
Okay. We want to thank Jack Santa Barbara for coming in today. He's given us a lot of good information.
Right. Thank you.
The whole suburban project, I think, can be summarized pretty succinctly as the greatest misallocation of resources in the history of the world. America took all of its post-war wealth and invested it in a living arrangement that has no future.
The basic cause of it all is the end of cheap and abundant energy.
Cheap oil is the party that we've been enjoying for the past 150 years. And that party is coming to an end. Within our lifetimes, we're going to see the end of the age of oil. And the result of that will be the end of the American way of life.
What the blackout actually was, it was a whole series of fuse boxes all tripping as we approached 100% capacity. The question wasn't the event. The question was, why did we ever allow ourselves to get so near peak capacity that it took just a branch or two to end up denying 57 million people life for several days? Everything in society that we cherished ended when the blackout came. And if that wasn't a fire drill for how important energy actually is, I can't imagine it. But you know what? People didn't get it. It wasn't a yellow light. It was a big red light. And I don't think we basically learned a thing from it.
We've been told by our president and vice president to expect war for the remainder of our lifetimes. The U.S. would not be in Iraq if that country didn't have oil. The only interest of the U.S. in the Middle East is oil.
Certainly from a military standpoint, we are witnessing a sequential war to control the last remaining oil reserves on the planet. That's the war that will not end in our lifetimes.
I think this war in Iraq was really what stimulated everybody's interest in this subject. Ironically, it did a bit of good, you could say, in that regard, because people would say, why the hell would you want to invade Iraq unless it had a critical role in oil? And it's now evident these weapons of mass destruction don't exist and never did exist, so there has to be some other reason.
Redefining radio.
Sanford Radio.